want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I want to thank Susan Hubbard of Salinas, California, for stepping up. You can help, too. Subscribe for as little as $5 a month. It's voluntary. All the information is at peterbcollins.com. And this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show is produced in collaboration with truthout.org. Truthout reporter Sam Ferguson checks in with us today from Buenos Aires, Argentina. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
You are covering a trial and a series of prosecutions of people who are being held responsible or accountable for the kidnapping and homicides, the disappearances that occurred back in the 1970s during Argentina's Dirty War. And today you're going to tell us about the trial of General Jorge Olivera Rovera, and I want to learn more about that. But give us a little background here, because there was an attempt at justice in the 1980s. Then an amnesty law was passed. The amnesty and some pardons have now been overturned. And so this is a very interesting process. And those of us in the United States who are willing to look backward, not forward, and seek accountability for wrongdoing here might see this as somewhat of a template. So give us a quick sketch of what happened in the 70s, and then when there were attempts to bring people to justice, and how it occurred going forward.
Well, that's right. The story, I suppose, begins in the early 1970s, when Argentina, like many countries in Latin America, was suffering from a more or less low-grade civil war. Kind of leftist guerrilla groups were squaring off against paramilitary squads in the streets on almost a daily basis. And eventually a state of siege was declared by the democratic government, calling the armed forces into most areas of the country. So the military took a very big role in domestic politics in the 70s. And as the economy began to crumble and the democratic government stopped speaking with all opponents or with any dissidents of the regime, the military took over in a bloodless coup, what appeared to be a bloodless coup, on March 24th, 1976, on a promise to restore security and law and order and the economy. They were welcomed with open arms, but quickly they implemented the most brutal reign of terror of all of the Latin dictatorships of the 1970s, known in English as the Dirty War. And the military disappeared. It's now become a verb. Around 10,000 suspected, quote-unquote, subversives, who were anybody from guerrillas who violently opposed the regime, to journalists, to dissidents, to psychiatrists of these people who the military thought might know some of the most intimate information of these people. There was even a raid against the notorious raid against a group of high school students, seven high school students, who went out into the street to protest a raise in school bus fares. And all seven of them were illegally kidnapped, taken to a secret prison, and six of them, while they were 16 or 17 years old, were shot point blank in the head. I mean, mm-hmm. this was right next to the Nazis. The scope of the repression and the horror that was implemented implemented in Argentina. So,
and there were infamous stories, for example, of people being taken on one-way helicopter rides and being dropped into the ocean?
Exactly. There's a naval base here in the city of Buenos Aires called the Navy School of Mechanics, and it's known by its Spanish acronym as the ESMA. It's this sprawling naval compound smack dab in the wealthiest part of Buenos Aires, and there, every Wednesday, they would take prisoners. They would drug prisoners who had been held illegally. Nobody knew their whereabouts. They would load them onto cargo planes, fly out over the Rio de la Plata, which is the giant river which borders Buenos Aires and Uruguay, and throw them into the river or the sea. Mm-hmm. And the army then began to copy that pattern of disappearing people and threw them into the delta out of cargo helicopters. And sometimes bodies would wash up on the shore, but in the vast majority of cases, the people who were killed, their bodies have never been found. They've never been identified, and the families, you know, continue to pore over the records of cemeteries for bodies that were interned without a name, hoping to find some remnants of their relatives.
And help us out with the Spanish here. Los desaparecidos, is that the correct term for the disappeared?
Desaparecidos.
Desaparecidos.
Yes. Yes.
And then the verb...
The disappeared.
The verb to disappear in Spanish?
Yes, desaparecer. Yeah, it's to desaparecer. It's interesting. The genesis of the term is originally human rights groups starting using this term because it was the most subtle way they could talk about the people who had gone missing in this reign of terror. It was very hard to oppose the regime. I mean, anybody who spoke up loudly enough was destined to become a victim. So groups of families who began to get together to search for their missing relatives began to simply talk about the people who had disappeared, because it's like there was no action involved. It's like they simply went missing. There was no accusation behind the word, because their first moves to look for their relatives had to be calm and subtle. So the genesis of this word, which now evokes horror and a very violent rupture of society, initially had this this kind of soft, timid connotation.
Mm-hmm. And so do we know, is there an estimate of the total number of people who did disappear during this era?
So when democracy returned in 1983, the first president who assumed power, his name was Raul Alfonsín, convened a truth commission, and they came to the conclusion that just under 9,000 people were disappeared by the regime. Some of those eventually were freed from prison, but the overwhelming majority of them remain unknown. The commission admitted that these figures were probably lower than the actual figures for a lack of information, and people still remained scared that there could be another military coup someday, and not all of them came forward. Human rights groups have always maintained that the number is about 30,000, and there's actually recently been a huge debate here about what the actual numbers is. But the most concrete number with names and dates of disappearance is around 9,000 people.
Mm-hmm. So, Sam, then, you say democracy returned in 83, and I understand that General Rivera was indicted in 1985. Tell us how that process went forward.
Yeah, that's correct. There was this very interesting process in Argentina in the 1980s. It became the first country in the history of the world to use domestic courts to prosecute its own military leaders. And, you know, some people look to the Nuremberg trials is the birth of human rights, but in some respects, Argentina superseded that moment. I mean, they used a domestic court here in the city of Buenos Aires to prosecute all nine members of the ruling military junta. It was this amazing moment known then and perhaps now as the trial of the century. Five of them were eventually convicted. Two were sentenced to life in prison. And after the juicio a las juntas, the trial of the junta, as it was known, the court and prosecutors then began to look one level down on in the military hierarchy. And when they did that, they indicted General Rovere and his superior, whose name was Guillermo Carlos Suarez Mason, and leaders of the Navy. But as this trial proceeded, the military began to reconvene and gained power. The lower-ranking officers were scared that these prosecutions would reach deep into the military. And when judges began to cite lower-ranking officials, the military staged a series of rebellions against the new democratic government. Now, this tremendously worried the government. There had been six successful coups in Argentina throughout the 20th century. The military always remained a very strong presence in domestic politics, and it forced the hand of the democratic government initially to pass an amnesty law that was targeted at lower-ranking officers to satisfy the restive spirit amongst the lower-ranking officers. But now Rovere was high enough that he was not spared prosecution by this amnesty, and his trial continued. Justice here always works very slowly, never mind the fact that these cases deal with hundreds of witnesses and hundreds of victims. So his case had not yet reached a courthouse by 1989, when a new president, Carlos Menem, assumed office. Now, several rebellions continued after the amnesty law was passed, and Menem thought that the best way to quell the rebellions was to pardon everybody whose cases were still proceeding. So Rovere, amongst about 40 other high-ranking officials from the military, was pardoned, and the case seemed to have been sealed shut then in 1989.
Mm-hmm. And as you look back at this, well, first of all, could you give us a quick civics lesson here in terms of the structure of the courts in Argentina? Because in some Latin American countries, the judge is actually the prosecutor as well. What's the breakdown of functions here? Is there a separate prosecutor, defense attorney, and judge in the case? And is there a jury?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. You know, the justice system here basically hasn't been updated in 400 years when it was a Spanish colony and is based on the European inquisitorial system. So it's very bureaucratic. It takes a very, very long time. It's mostly done through paper. It's only been recently that they in fact use oral trials here. So the process starts with what's called an instructional judge, who is kind of like a mix of a prosecutor and a judge. They actually have the investigative powers that a prosecutor might in the United States, but then they also have the power to call and subpoena witnesses and to put the accused under preventive detention, which the prosecutors in the United States don't have. Now, there's also a prosecutor during this first phase of the trial as well, and it's not really clear what the differences between their roles are, but for whatever reason, there is still a judge and a prosecutor at these initial stage. That judge then sends the case over to another judge who's in charge of the oral phase of the trial, and the entire trial moves to a separate set of people. So you have one prosecutor, one judge, and one defense attorney in this initial phase where the accused are indicted and the evidence against the accused is accumulated, and they send everything to an oral trial. And at that point, another judge and another prosecutor take over, though the defense attorneys are usually the same. Now, the trials themselves are also very different. There's no juries here in Argentina, and the judges ask all of the questions. Trials are usually in front of three-judge tribunals, and the witnesses actually face the bench with their back towards the audience at any case. Now, these judges ask all the questions, they develop all of the evidence, and they're the ones that ultimately make a ruling. The attorneys, in fact, play very little role in the oral part of the trial. It's a much different justice system. So the trials you see here are not what you would expect in an American courtroom.
And Sam, how would you characterize the independence of these judges in the first phase as well as the three-judge tribunals?
In a word, not very independent. The justice system in Argentina is notoriously corrupt on a number of fronts. Judges routinely take money to decide cases one way or the other. But corruption works in more subtle ways, that the justice system tends to follow the political winds, and judges sometimes withhold trials or withhold information to bring them out when the political winds seem right to do so. So, for instance, the current president, her name is Cristina Kirchner. She succeeded her husband, who was president for 4 years before her.
Right.
The couple has been wildly popular for about 6 years, but within the last year they have suffered a precipitous drop in popularity. And all of a sudden, you see judges across the country opening up corruption cases against the couple, even though they surely could have discovered this information years ago. So it's a very interesting, the judges certainly have their fingers on the political pulse of the country, which is one interesting thing about these cases, is that, you know, in many respects, it's a real triumph of human rights that the victims of Argentina's last military dictatorship are finally being brought to justice after so many years where the accused, you know, could drink coffee in the same cafe as their victims. And the Kirchners made a big point of pursuing these cases as part of their political strategy. And when the judges saw that that seemed to be the way the political winds were moving, all of a sudden these cases opened back up again in the early 2000s. But now that the Kirchners are suffering in popularity, it will be interesting to see what happens with these cases in two or three more years.
We're talking with Sam Ferguson, Truth Out reporter in Buenos Aires. Now, Sam, in your article, you point out that General Rovere, was indicted in 85, and then in 1989, he was pardoned by Carlos Menem, and that stood until 2004. Now, in the United States, a pardon is absolute, and to my knowledge, I've never heard of a presidential pardon overturned by a court. But that did happen in 2004. Tell us the circumstances and the nature of that decision.
That's true. So courts here in Argentina have taken a very expansive reading of international law to open these cases back up, which everybody thought were sealed shut since the 1980s. They've said that under treaties signed by American states under the Inter-American Treaty for Human Rights, and other international treaties, that crimes against humanity, that is, massive crimes committed by the state, can never be pardoned, can never be amnestied, and the state cannot impose a statute of limitations on prosecuting those cases. Now, many of these treaties were, in fact, signed by Argentina or ratified and given constitutional status by Argentina after the Dirty War, but courts have applied these treaties and this reading of international law retroactively to say that the laws and the pardons passed in the 1980s are in fact unconstitutional and illegal under international law, and have reopened prosecutions against many of the military officials who were originally pardoned and then amnestied in the 1980s.
Now, that appeals to my bias, but what about double jeopardy? Is there a ban on double jeopardy in the Constitution in Argentina?
There is one in the Constitution. There is also something like collateral estoppel, which is a concept in the United States that once something has been adjudicated by a court, you can't relitigate the same issue. It's related to double jeopardy. Here it's called cosa juzgada, which means the thing is judged. In fact, it is in the Constitution, but as I mentioned earlier, courts have been giving a very expansive reading to international law and international norms, and have said that this trumps the presidential faculty to pardon people, that the pardon in the first instance was null and void, and any court decisions so saying were wrong. So the cases have now been opened back up.
Very interesting. The legal wrangling here is fascinating. So, starting in February of this year, the court has been hearing witnesses and reviewing documents and testimony related to General Rovere. Give us a quick sketch of how that has progressed to the present point.
So the trial began in February of 2009. As you said earlier, it really began in February 2004 when he was indicted again, shall we say. But justice here moves incredibly slowly. Rovere spent 3 years in preventive detention until he was ordered released by a federal appeals court here. So he has walked into courtroom a free man, to the chagrin of many human rights organizations. Over 400 witnesses have appeared in this case, and the prosecutor's strategy has been to show that below Rovere was a structure where people were kidnapped, taken, tortured, and executed within the city of Buenos Aires, where Rovere had command for the army.
Mm-hmm. And the defense team is a father-son team named Norberto and Nicholas Giletta. And you point out that the senior Giletta is a former judge. He was on the bench during the dictatorship.
So this is a very, very charged trial, and the defense has given a very, very charged defense for their defendant, Rovere, and that's correct. Norberto Giletta was a judge and an infamous judge during the dictatorship. The judicial system under the dictatorship worked hand in hand, for the most part, with the military. Immediately upon taking power, the military demanded that all judges either sign like a loyalty oath to the military and the statutes that the military would pass, or they purged judges who refused to do so. Now, there were judges and there were judges during the military regime, and Giletta showed his stripes and clearly favored the military regime. In fact, I was just talking about 20 minutes ago to Robert Cox, who was the editor of the Buenos Aires Herald, which is an English language paper here in Buenos Aires, which during the 70s was one of the best newspapers on the planet. They absolutely refused to give in to threats and intimidation and government censorship during the dictatorship. And Giletta, at one point, ordered Mr. Robert Cox to prison for a time because of the reporting that the Herald was doing on the widespread disappearances within the city that all other newspapers essentially had refused to do. So this is a very, very charged case with interesting participants, and it's taken on a charged political tone.
And what is the theory or the thread being presented by the defense team?
So they have two theories. One defense is, like I said, a political defense. The military took power in very, very dangerous times here in Argentina. One should not understate the real violence that guerrilla groups were doing in Argentina. Just a week before the coup, 40 bodies had turned up in the streets, about half of which were victims of left-wing violence. I mean, there was a giant bomb that blew up the Central Army Command just steps from the Casa Rosada, which is like the Argentine White House, about a week before the coup. So the defense in this case has used the fact that there was tremendous left-wing violence to say anything that the military did during this time was legal. You have to understand that this was a war. Now, that argument falls flat because under the Geneva Conventions, if in fact you can describe what happened as a war, which is also doubtful, then the military would have had to have treated prisoners of war under the dictates of the convention. You know, it's one thing to go to war and shoot your enemy. It's another thing to capture that enemy, torture him for information, and exterminate him when you're through with them. It's clearly illegal under the Geneva Conventions. They've also used a defense to say that the military was acting under legal orders signed under a democratic president. They're using the argument that the state of siege ordered under democracy before the coup gave them the legal power and legal authority to do what they did. Now, they're also trying to distance Rovere from the disappearances and executions that took place once prisoners were taken to clandestine centers. The defense is trying to say that Rovere was, in fact, ignorant of or not responsible for what happened to prisoners once they were taken outside of his command. And they've tried to distance Rovere from the torture and execution by saying that this happened in places that were outside of the city of Buenos Aires and were thus outside of his command, or that the people who were arrested were part of the leftist organizations and were arrested legally. If anybody did anything worse to them, they're saying it wasn't his fault. Now, the prosecution has said that that's just absolutely unbelievable. As the highest authority in the city of Buenos Aires, he had to have known what was going on below him, and he was the one that had the power to say, when you take a prisoner, you can't torture them. When you take a prisoner, you have to declare them. They have to be legal. So the prosecution is saying that Rovere played an essential role in implementing the anti-subversive policies of the military government, and as such has to be found guilty.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, as you're describing this, there's a chill running up my spine, because I am just constantly thinking of parallels here in our own country with the Bush-Cheney hierarchy and efforts to bring them to justice, which are not being supported by the Obama administration and by Attorney General Holder to this date. But, gosh, I hope we don't have to wait 33 years for real investigations and real accountability for those who cross the line with many of the same arguments, you know, that oh, gosh, they had memos from the Justice Department that said it was okay and that we were in a war on terror and that anything that was done to protect the people, in our case, American people, in your case, Argentinians, was acceptable. And so it's just chilling to me to hear this, because I do see it as somewhat of a preview of what should take place in the United States.
Yeah, as you said, I mean, there are many parallels here. The justifications for the type of activities that each of the governments engaged in are substantially the same. I mean, the Argentine government says we're facing a subversive terrorist threat. That's exactly what our government has said. In fact, many of the practices that they used were the same, that waterboarding, known here as the submarino, was one of the favorite tactics of the intelligence units that brought in prisoners. Ironically, President Carter passed sanctions against Argentina for using this exact practice during the 1970s, which today Dick Cheney defends as an essential interrogation tactic that we need to capture terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
So it was torture for the United States in the 1970s, and today it's a quote-unquote enhanced interrogation technique. Where the analogy falls apart, but where it's even more disturbing what's happened in the United States, perhaps, is that in Argentina, the military did their utmost to make this a secretive campaign and to hide all shred of evidence of what happened. I mean, the media was censored. There was no public discussion about what was going on. What's scarier, perhaps, in the United States is that it was all done under the mark of legality. The highest legal authorities in our democratic government signed on to the campaign, such as John Yoo, Bybee, Addington, Dick Cheney. It's that there has been a real rupture of the legal system in the United States in a way that there wasn't in Argentina, which makes it even more difficult to deal with what happened in the United States. And we'll see what happens. Obviously, Barack Obama has not made this a priority, and we'll have to see what happens with the Holder investigation. You know, it's interesting here in Argentina that Balthazar Garzon, who is the Spanish judge who recently ordered an investigation into some of the highest Bush administration officials, became famous in 1998 for indicting Augusto Pinochet, who mm-hmm. was the dictator in Chile. And he later indicted and prosecuted several Argentine officials while the amnesty was in effect here in Argentina. Now, in Argentina, a lot of judges have looked at Garzon's activity and are embarrassed by that. They've said, how is it that an international tribunal, a foreign court, is prosecuting the people we should be prosecuting in our country? And the reaction has been just the opposite in the United States. How dare that Spanish judge do things that our justice system should be doing? This is our decision to make. So the reactions are quite different. I just mention it because it's an interesting difference between the countries. It
certainly is. Do you have any information that General Rovere is an alumni of the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia?
I have not looked into that. There are certainly members of the upper echelons of the Argentine military who went to the School of the Americas. I don't know if Rovere himself is an alumni, but I can certainly look that up and get back to you.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know. So the status is that we're basically at the final argument stage of the case, and then it will be submitted to this three-judge panel. Do you have any indication from the court how quickly they might rule?
Yeah, so today a public defender spoke on behalf of one of the other of the five accused in the case. Rovere has actually been brought to trial with four of the people who worked under him, and this should last probably through next week. The court then has the legal obligation to decide within 10 days, but the legal obligations aren't necessarily how these things work in practice. We should probably see a verdict sometime near the end of August, and then judges here, unlike the United States, are required to give written justification for the sentence, and that should come out.
And let me just clarify, you just said August. Did you mean November?
I'm sorry, I meant October. We should probably see a verdict sometime in October, and we'll see the sentence, the written sentence, with the legal basis for the decision sometime in November.
Okay, great. And, Sam, is there anything else you'd like to add from your observance of this case? And there are others, I presume, that will follow it.
So the tribunal that's hearing this case, known as the Federal Oral Criminal Tribunal Number 5, has been hearing the overwhelming majority of the human rights cases for the last 2 years. And the next case in the pipeline involves 17 of the people who worked at the ESMA, which is that naval center we mentioned earlier, where human rights groups estimate that some 5,000 people passed through this place. Those 17 accused will go to trial beginning November 19th, and I'll be writing periodic updates on the trial for Truthout once it begins. It's a really horrendous case. One of the central cases within the grand case is this man named Alfredo Astiz worked at the ESMA and infiltrated a group of mothers of disappeared children known as the Madres, the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. They went all around the government looking for their children. They tried to get in the press. They were unsuccessful. And in 1977, about a year after many of their children were disappeared, they met in an activist kind of left-wing church to try and get money together to place the first advertisement in a Spanish-language newspaper with the information of their disappeared children to see if anybody had any information on their whereabouts. Now, Astiz, who worked at the ESMA, had been going to these meetings under false pretenses. He said his name was Gustavo Nino and that he had a disappeared brother. Now, when the mothers went to the church in December 1977, Astiz had sent information back to the ESMA, and a work group, as the intelligence units were known, stormed the church, picked up a dozen people, took them back to the ESMA, and none of them have ever been seen since. I mean, it's just emblematic of the repression that was brought down on opponents of the regime. So that's the most well-known case within the ESMA case, which is coming up soon.
Well, Sam, thank you for an excellent conversation here today, and I appreciate your reporting from the scene there in Buenos Aires. And we'll do a follow-up as you continue to file dispatches from Argentina.
Peter, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure being with you today.
Muchísima gracias. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments, send them to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.